Hello and welcome to the Serious Games Podcast, all about playful methods for interactive trainings and facilitation. Let's get started.
And welcome back to the Serious Games Podcast. And today, once again, I have two guests. I'm looking forward to this conversation because I will be traveling in a couple of weeks. I will be traveling to the UK, to the University of Exeter. And there, the Playposium 2026 will happen. Now, if you look this up online and in the social media, you will see this is a gathering dedicated to explore how play can bring more human and pro-social forms of society. And of course, that's worth a full episode, maybe multiple episodes, once I'm back. And it's in the UK, apparently, for the first time. Okay, we'll get into all the backstory, how it happened, what it is, what InnoPlay Studio is, and of course, how Martin Kooners and Andy Adam Lesby are connected and when you really had this idea. Well, first of all, to both of you, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Julian. Great to be here.
Thank you, Julian. Really good to
be here. And here's my traditional questions, okay? What should our listeners know about you? And how do you pitch, how do you describe the Playposium in an elevator pitch style?
What do they need to know about you?
What do they need to know about you, Adam?
What they need to know about me is I think something about me that maybe we sort of don't discuss enough is the types of play that sort of I do a lot of running, I do a lot of gardening, and I do a lot of work in innovation entrepreneurship because that's my discipline area. And I actually don't see much of a difference between those three worlds. And I think that is, for me, the interesting thing about this world of play that I've accidentally fallen into. I think should we, you go and then we'll do the elevator pitch.
Mm-hmm. Know about me. I always like to not be in a box, but that is, I think, good to know. But the boxes that I do fit in is that I am trained as a researcher in life sciences. So I back in a lifetime, it feels now, did research in kidney disease. But always since I was a kid, I liked playing games, making games, breaking games, at least the rules, both in the games, but also in life. I always thought I was the odd duckling in my family until I actually left the Netherlands and traveled the world and worked on different places and thought, oh, I'm not the odd duckling. My parents and my brothers are the odd ducklings. Maybe they're listening. Hello.
Revelation. Well, wonderful. Well, that is quite something, right? From kidneys to play and from the circular economy to play. Let's start with the Playposium, and then I'm sure I will get out a few more details of why and what you're doing, and especially Adam, what you just said there. There is play as a state rather than play as something separate from work or life or maybe more. So Playposium, what is it?
Playposium is a unique gathering, and it's an experience that is place based. So. Mm-hmm. Last year it was in Colorado up in the mountains. This year it is in a very large festival tent at the University of Exeter in the English countryside. And so that's what it is. And I put it probably, there's a lot of people who want us to sort of define it more, but it defines itself by where it is and who turns up.
In countryside, Exeter, South UK. Right now, though, I understood you are a little bit up north in Tiverton, where you both live. Is that correct?
Yeah, Martin's recently moved here. Uh-huh. I've lived here for over 10 years.
Okay.
And it's on the X River, which runs down through to Exeter, and
uh-huh.
It's a lovely rolling hills, English countryside, beautiful place.
Okay, sounds already very playful. What made Exeter the right place for the Playposium to land right after Colorado?
Yeah, so I think this was, we were heavily involved in LA, which was the first physical in-person one. Martin's Dutch, so he sort of just invited himself. Like, he was like, David, Lisa, we're coming, and we're going to, yep, you know. And then when we got there, we're like, oh, we're going to do some of this. And they're very gracious and generous people, and they let us get quite involved. And that then led into us being very heavily involved last year for Colorado and really curating the experience. And the first one was about techniques. We were very focused on what sort of activates play. Mm-hmm. Then we moved in Colorado. We very much looked at you, the playful stance of the individual, and worked very hard to curate something that was really about the person. And it made sense this year to go, right, playful society. And I think it, you know, it was difficult when we were traveling to the States last year. It was difficult to work out were we welcome. Was there any challenges at the borders? And we, when we were doing Playposium, we were like, well, this is the year that it probably, if it's going to leave the US, maybe this is a good year for it just to have a year somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Things are very uncertain in the world. And so we thought that this was the opportunity. And then at the same time, this theme was bubbling up with us, this playful society. So what does it mean? What does it look like, and maybe what does it contrast? So in our view, we think that there's a generosity, a kindness, a joy to play, and maybe not to get too political, but a little bit just to say that when you see sort of cruelty or some sort of like putting down or bullying of others, play actually, even in children, play actually breaks that down. It helps get rid of the difference. And so we were very, very keen to bring it to Exeter, not for a political reason, but for the contextual reasons. And then to say, right, well, play brings people together. Let's celebrate that. And let's put that on the stage in England.
And to build on that is that, yes, last 5 years or so, we've been developing a whole community here in Exeter around playful pedagogy and innovation through play. And we were always in the back of our mind where we wanted some kind of gathering here anyway. So when the planets aligned, Playposium came to us.
And I suppose that brings us on, Julian. We've got this amazing group of volunteers this year.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so we've been actually able to build something that is much bigger and than us, and is quite mad and wonderful, because we've got this incredible group of folk who, some of them will be volunteering on the day, some of them will be actually taking part and have been doing all the work beforehand. So it's really lovely to have that celebration.
All right, well, let's start, because now I'm just, you know, going through my questions, but I'm let's start with the Playposium and the setup, and you know, it's a multi-day gathering, and can you walk us through a little bit what I would expect? I will be the, you know, first timer, so how would it feel like? What will it be like for me, and
not
how can
question,
I
feel like?
And how can I not have FOMO with everything happening? And then we'll get a little bit more into your background and all the other wonderful things that you're doing, and of course your motivation. So arriving, I'm going to fly in. I'm going to take the train down to Exeter. Yeah. And I think I'm going to live at the university. Yeah, I think they have a guest house there. So
yeah,
what will be happening?
Well, let's start with a couple of things. Exeter is just on the 2-hour mark by train from London. So it's closer than people necessarily realize when you look on the map. And it's a beautiful train ride, particularly once you get into the southwest. Exeter itself is a cathedral town city, and it's nestled on the Ex River. So it's got a river that runs through it that then goes down to a large estuary. And then the university is set in an old arboretum, so it's got these beautiful trees, and it's on a hill in Exeter. So it's we're very fortunate for our campus is heavily treed, and there's a very beautiful site in itself. I won't say all of our buildings that were built in the 50s and 60s and even more recently are beautiful things, but at least the trees are gorgeous. And so you arrive in Exeter, an old Roman settlement, so we have a Roman wall. It's got some really deep history, so that's also something about Exeter that sort of you can feel when you're in the place. heavily bombed in the Second World War, so has some of that as well to feel like leftover 50s and 60s architecture that was not maybe the best thought out stuff in a town. And then the university itself, you come up and it's on a hill, and it's a campus university. So we've got a large campus, and the business school's at one end, at the bottom of, luckily at the bottom of one of the, bottom of half a hill, I suppose. It's still a hill. And that, and then we've got a sort of lovely U-shaped building, set of buildings. And behind there, when you arrive, there'll be a big red and white
strawberry and cream colored
strawberry and cream colored tent.
What a, I will choose to not put pictures in the podcast just to leave everyone with their own imagination and how it looks, and then arrive at Exeter and have a look if it matches.
And then I don't know if we actually propose how you're going to feel. We our participants on the feedback is different emotions and different experiences. But what we are, what we definitely are in the fore of our mind is that you'll have the opportunity to meet the participants and us, and that's really a large part of it is the pro, what we call the pro-social aspect of Playposium. And so there's things where maybe if you looked at another conference, you would end up sort of registering and maybe going into having a coffee in a big room, and you know, you might be sort of awkwardly trying to find somebody to talk to, and we work a bit of magic there, and we don't believe in that sort of awkwardness at the start of anything or during anything. So we've worked quite hard at creating space for people to naturally and easily connect. And that's often that's part of our InnoPlay work, Julian. At InnoPlay, we've really worked hard on how do we get to a space that is warm and connected really quickly. So we do a lot of work. We do a lot of work in that area.
Got you. And let me just ask a deep question, okay? Right. Of course, I'm responsible for my feelings, but still, you're inviting, right? And you deliberately, for example, you know, decided not to have that traditional, okay, keynotes, workshops, 4-day cognitive overload. But you definitely.
Oh, no, there'll be some cognitive overload.
Okay. I thought I get
it. Oh, yeah, that's happening. That's happening, Julian. Don't worry about that. We're definitely then, doing
cognitive overload. There's some, you know, unique ways that you're crafting this invitation, right? And that you're making sure that there will be, and I'm not going to call it like networking, right? But that there will be those moments, those encounters, those meetings, those connective moments. How do you do that? I mean, especially when you say at InnoPlay that's also core of your work. Can you give us a few tips or tricks or what is important to you?
Go on, give them the recipe of the secret sauce. Julian wants the recipe. I know Julian does this already, so it's okay.
I think with the cognitive overload, the difference here is not we're throwing all the information, all the tracks at you. It's an invitation to join us on a journey. If you sometimes want to step away from a journey, that we encourage that if you need that. But we continuously invite you on the journey, and we play with energy, with focus, divergent thinking, etc. In a couple of ways, and one thing that usually is a little bit in the back of the most things is if you compare it to a conference, quite often the most networking or idea creating is not in that room with the expert being on a pedestal giving you all the information. It is having meaningful conversations at the coffee table or at the water cooler. So we try to have those moments much longer and much more intertwined. And the other thing, I think often when we're talking about play, we think about activities. We love to say we think play as a feeling than an activity of a game. And it doesn't mean it has to be always happy, clappy, fun, joy feeling. It has to be the whole human experience, because everyone who comes to a gathering brings their whole self. And in the beginning, you've got lots of assumptions, a bit of reservations, the conversations that can be awkward. And we're trying a lot of disturbances, distractions to create and remind people they're humans, And what are the human needs? The human needs are for connection and belonging, certainty, uncertainty. So we're really approaching the experience from all those needs rather than just certainty, for example, or just information.
Yes. You go first.
I think to answer your question directly about how do we do it, there's this really interesting thing. You put people, let's just say an activity. So it could be a small game. We often talk about Dobble because it's spotted in the US. It's sort of our gateway game drug sort of way in, because you just play. It's so easy to teach, so easy to do. But whatever it is, if you give people an activity and they get immersed in that activity, it sort of takes away a lot of the social anxiety around standing around with a group of intelligent apes you don't know. So we've observed that people are very comfortable. We're very comfortable jumping on a plane with a bunch of strangers, right, and flying. I mean, I fly down to Australia, New Zealand, so, you know, 12, 14 hours at a time, but you're not interacting with them. So it's a non-social aspect to that. What makes it important here is that it's going to be a social aspect. But people, I think in the past, what has been thought of as social is, oh, people have to talk and people have to interact and they have to, you know, you have to play some sort of networking game. And I have nothing against networking games, particularly at certain points. But we've got the luxury of time. So we want people to settle in, find each other slowly and gently, and then and explore. And I think that is that sort of giving somebody an activity around something that is not forced to interact. And then that will happen at the Playposium right at the outset. And then you can start to build on that. I think that's the, we put at the beginning of our workshop sessions, we call it a soft start. And we always start with small games and we're 15, 20 minutes. And a lot of colleagues will be like, oh, that's a lot of time, especially if you've only got 2 hours. But the difference in the room that you receive after people have had a focused activity that isn't forcing them to be not who they are or anything like that, the difference in the room is palpable. And I think that's something that we have experienced firsthand with play. And so we know that it sort of unlocks this social aspect. And then you go from there.
Yes. I mean, for me, here's the uncomfortable truth for me, right? There are a lot of things that I see and observe and are drawn into. And it's not about conferences. It could be any training session. It doesn't matter if online or on-site, right? And it's labeled as play, but then it triggers exactly that social anxiety, right? It's like, okay, now we're going to go around the circle. And everyone is like, oh, my God, what am I going to say? You're losing 98% of, you know, what others have been contributing because you're really just focused on, okay, what am I going to say? What am I going to say? Okay, now it's my turn. Okay, 30 more seconds. Oh my God, the person in front of me is skipping. Now it's directly on the spot, right? So what for you is the difference? And again, I understand, you know, 4 days and settling in and you know, as an invitation, but what for you is really the difference? And what would you tell someone who observed that? It's like, whoa, but I used that game. And still, it didn't click. Still, there was this awkward feeling inside the room. Like, what did I do wrong? Right. So where are your where's your advice
a couple of things there. Observe a bunch of 5-year-olds who haven't met each other for the first time, and see how that. It's not about their name. It's not about what school. It's not about, you know, oh, my parents are this. They go and they start playing and then they start to introduce themselves. And I think that's a key to our some of this. The sort of level of, oh, I've got to introduce myself. And I think that's something that we really go back to. We go, where is play happening most organically? And it's in our children, right? And so I think that's something to unpick and think about. Martin will pick that up in a second and go further, but the part about, oh, does this game work or not? We're very comfortable with the idea that or the confidence that people will work it out for themselves or they'll work through it. And that takes a bit of courage from the front of the room or wherever you're curating this from. It's about stepping back and letting people have that messy experience, work it out for themselves sometimes. Mm. What we observe too often in facilitation and education is a desire to over-explain, to get in and really work it. And you're interrupting the social flow. You're interrupting the five-year-old who's just gone up to this other kid and said, should we go and climb that tree? That's the conditions you're trying to create. So if somebody's asking themselves, oh, what went wrong? I don't think there's a right and wrong. There is a practice of how do we create space for these intelligent apes to just be together for a bit, work it out, and then build into, you know, there's often a status requirement, particularly in academia. Who's in the room? Have I got the dean in the room? So sometimes we do have to say, right, we've done a bit of play, and then we've got to do this, I would call it the sort of status anxiety that's in the room. So there's a bit of that, but that comes after. That doesn't come before, because what you said, it's like it just gets in the way of connection.
I think that example that you gave about round the circle, there are a couple of things to unpack there. I suppose that in contrast to over-explaining, we were quite, as a society, we're very focused on certainty. When does lunch exactly start? Where do I have to be, etc.? How long is going to be this lecture or this activity? And we purposely and intentionally create a level of ambiguity or uncertainty where you don't know that you are next giving so you're
even worse. Oh my God.
Quite often we have a little bit, we do like the shared uncomfortableness, but we're using it as a dial to make sure it doesn't go over. And by ambiguity, there's a little bit more of a surprise element, the journey that I was talking about. And the two other things here is noticing that if you do a circle, that not everyone is comfortable with it, or no one, and intentional. So if we want you to feel a little bit anxious and thinking about what I'm going to say, then we do something like that. But then that it has to be the intention, not the intention, oh, let's get to know each other, because there are other ways, like during a game, or we have an activity where you pair up and tell the story of your name, and that is such a simple activity, but it's hard to let people stop talking about the story of the name. Well, they never thought about there is a story about their name. So there is this playing around with levers and dials around this how comfortable people are, because we don't shy away from the uncomfortableness, but it has to be an intention that we want to go somewhere.
Yes. Yes, and I think I really want to plus that, right, and say what you're describing is you're combining these parameters or elements, right, of intention, of focus, of activity, of anxiety or feelings in that sense, right? And once you thought this through, again, we're still in the room in that moment, right? And we're there to support, and we're there to also reframe or to re-explain if needed, right? But then you're there, you can see how it unfolds, right? Rather than, again, of course, exaggerating a little bit, you know, taking 7 bullet points from the internet and running it with your team tomorrow morning and then saying, oh my God, that didn't work, right? So there's many more things that we do then also. And that's really, you know, my personal interest also for the podcast, you know, who is the one that's inviting to play, and how do we support, how do we challenge, how do we readjust, how do we frame and reframe and you know, craft that. I maybe call it now like the constant invitation, right, to interact when we're spending time together, right?
Yeah. Yeah, very much. The thing that pops up for me there is we sort of have a bit of a warm, fuzzy feeling come over us when our participants sort of disrupt something that we thought was going to go some one way, and then they're like, no, we're going to do it this way, and they've sort of taken control of the room. And that's really sort of for us is where play turns up, is we've got people in the room who've like, no, I'm going to do it this way, and I'm going to go and do this, and this is going to happen. And we're like, wow, okay, now we've we've created a monster, but that is the monster we're trying to create. And this is the experience of last year with Playposium up in Colorado. We were all together and sort of an old girl guides camp up in the Colorado mountains. And, you know, the first day everyone arrives and it's all quite sort of settled, and I would almost call it polite. And then, you know, it doesn't take much, but sort of by the second day, people are starting to rebel and starting to push and change things. And that to us is that from that discomfort to comfort that is so useful.
Oh, absolutely. Even, I mean, again, this is, we're talking about the conference, you know, the gathering setup, and we're going to talk about the program in a second, because I think this conversation was triggered by us talking before the recording started about where is the program? what I wanted to say, of course, it's different than if I'm more in corporate learning, right? Of course, it's different when you have this more, I would say, if the roles and rules and unspoken rules and the status and the anxiety or psychological safety, etc., is already, you know, predefined by what the team or the organization has been going through. Okay, of course, for the gathering, I'm voluntarily there. I'm happy to contribute. So, of course, we're in a different stance and mood, I would say.
Yeah, real difference between... So when we do work with a set group, I would actually say we prefer a diverse group. We do find that actually having a room that doesn't know each other is actually our sweet spot, because the room that knows each other, it needs quite significant leadership. Yes. Probably outside of our remit, right? Leadership to step into the space. But that's an interesting difference for us that we've worked across. Yes. But we definitely see, if you've got a heterogeneous versus homogeneous group, the differences in the ability to activate the social, and also the serendipity. See, a heterogeneous group like Playposium, the potential for serendipity is just huge.
Of course, yes. And
so that is also part of the excitement here. Yeah,
absolutely. No, I mean, maybe, you know, we can have that conversation once I'm in Exeter, or maybe afterwards. I know you're all, knee deep in with organizing, but then...
We're doing Amazon orders at the moment, Julian.
It's oh, my God. So...
And if anyone knows anything about universities, it's through the corporate university purchasing system. So, you know, oh, my God, it's in triplicate.
Right, you can write a checklist for that afterwards. But back to Playposium, okay? Because, look, where is the program then? Okay, because I understand, right? We're there. It's just slow warm up, right? Or you phrase it, you know, the soft start, and then we have time for that. I will ask you later what you responded to that colleague that said 15 minutes in a 2-hour session. But what happens then, right? What else? What else is there for us to explore and to be invited to?
Yeah, I think there's so let's just to go about why we're the sort of it's not, the schedule isn't like fully published minute by minute. I think it is about, we know this is something that we take from learning through discovery or inquiry. There in education, there's intended learning outcomes or learning outcomes. The objectives, the learning objectives that we are very focused on, but because they're the output and the world is focused on outcomes and outputs, we often put those up front and we say, this is what we're going to do and this is where we're going to go. The human brain is a complex organ, and therefore it doesn't head in a straight linear line to anything. So you're putting something up like that, and I think it works for certain subjects. So I'm not going to say that putting your objectives up front aren't useful for some subjects, but for most subjects, what you actually want to learn to do is to discover the learning as they go and build the neural networks as they go, right? So putting your ILOs up is often like putting a ceiling up to, oh, this is all you're going to achieve. Now in my subject, innovation entrepreneurship, whoa, you don't want limits. You want to be able to go as far as you can and not have a box that says this is what I'm going to learn. So in something that's more subjective and more open and more exploratory, the idea of giving people this information and this is the journey, the assumptions just start to fall in, the ceilings start to form, probably some concrete actually sets, right? Before you've even gone through it. So one of the things we're doing here is saying, oh, we haven't set the concrete. The concrete hasn't been poured. Mm. And a certain amount of the concrete will be poured and set as we go through the experience. And it'll be individual to each and every person. So I think that's the premise of this openness. To give our listeners a little bit of a clue, we have a 5-minute by 5-minute TikTok schedule.
I just wanted to say there is a program.
There is a program. Whew, now I'm relieved. I'm happy to board that plane.
It sort of circles back to that intention setting with the activities, with the circle that we were talking about, is that the program will also unfold. Some will be in the moment, but for example, we have a city takeover on the Wednesday, which is a bit quite a mad program in itself, and that will be released not only on the Wednesday but a little bit earlier, so you can pick and choose. So there is a program, but it will unfold with intention when we unfold it. And if someone has too much anxiety around it and ask, I need to be somewhere, or I need something, my medication with lunch, etc., we will give you that information.
We're not cruel.
No, of course not.
It is at times that we could be.
Here's my thing. I'm doing a little series, right? So I had Matthias Posen on from Counterplay, and for the series play conference that was just released with Philip. And I was, you know, sometimes it's really hard to explain. But still, you know, for some listeners, I think it's very interesting to just get a flavor of, okay, who's behind? What is it about? So that they can decide, right, to join or not. And there's so many things that were just triggered in my head right now. I totally get the idea of that ceiling, right? It's like, look, I was reminded when I was teaching this entrepreneurship class, and then it was like, okay, goal is, you know, a business model canvas, right? And then you explain, and then that's the ceiling, right? And I think I stole that activity from a conductor, right? I had the students write me a letter after every session, right? So what they learned and what it was like to be in that. And that was part of, you know, how I graded. I said, look, you just have to write it. And it was so interesting that sometimes, they wrote, you know, 2 pages on a game that we played, or things that I just said in a side sentence, right? Or things that they went on to research, right? And very interesting. The ceiling, the outcome, the intent, yes. Wow. Where will I ask next?
Well, we can reveal a little bit of what's on the program.
Let's do a little bit of reveal. Because it's not totally hidden. I mean, the keynotes are up on the website.
Yes,
there's a few key people coming, and what we will also, you know, just caveat this with is we love a little bit of a chocolate bit of surprise, you know, like what's something that people don't know about, and we work really hard at sort of like, oh, this thing's going to bubble up, it's going to happen, and so we're not going to mention those things. But you know, we've got Lisa Forbes coming over from Professors at Play, and David Thomas. And Lisa's our first keynote experience on the Monday evening. And Lisa's work at the moment is really fascinating. She's in the middle of she's near the end of writing a book on play from her perspective. And we're very interested to see what this comes out, because I think she is one of those intellectually curious people who's really probing at what play is and what it means. Mm-hmm. And so we're excited to put that on the stage as a starter for us in terms of defining what this gathering is going to be.
Correct. And help me out, Adam. I think she's also representing the National Institute for Play, right?
We've got Mia Sandstrom from the National Institute of Play. So Mia's the CEO. She's Stuart Brown's granddaughter. She's taken over as CEO. She's also there, and they're working together. They collaborate. They're in Denver, Colorado together.
Gotcha.
And Mia's on the Tuesday. So there's a lot of that, and then Martin's already mentioned the Wednesday takeover. Our participants all could be on the stage, right? They could all be somewhere on a stage, like that's who comes. So you've got a room of incredible diverse expertise around this subject area. And so on the Wednesday, we're celebrating that as sort of across a more, you know, it's like a tracked event, but it's in the middle of Exeter, across Exeter. And so let the madness unfold. And I suppose the other thing we've got, which we haven't mentioned, is Tuesday night, which is our dinner. And that again is us saying, right, if you have a normal conference dinner, my God, if you sat next to the wrong person, God help you, you sat there for 2-3 hours, yeah. You know? And so how do we make this something memorable? How do we inject play? And this is where we bring in Gameful, and so really celebrating the Gameful side.
Yeah, so we've got Chris Chanson, which is an expert about Gameful learning, and he can make his modules or what's the American name?
Courses
into a game, and not necessarily just to make it a game, but really using the mechanics of why games are engaging, but also combining that with the premise that if you look at education, there is so much game already in it. You've got points, you've got levels, you've got rewards. So he has been doing that for years and created a wonderful course around vampires. And we've combined his expertise with the professor of storytelling, Robin Mello, to curate, design a very engaging dinner around vegan vampires.
Vegan vampire games.
Wonderful, wonderful.
So dinner will be, there'll be game, and there'll be, and so I think this is Playposium, right? Where how do we tease out, but also how do we share? So even though it's going to be this sort of fantastical theatrical experience, at the same time the layer of you know, oh, that this works this way and this happens here and oh, they've used this, they're all up for grabs. So all the way through, there's going to be that notion of, okay, we're going from one thing to the next. I think we've said enough. I think that is plenty.
Tell me, how many colleagues, how many participants are you expecting? And I'm going to, of course, link all the websites and the dates. So that's clear.
So 100 of us in the tent.
And plus the team, right? And you just shortly mentioned there's a lot of volunteers that help to do what? Will they be?
Yeah, so most of the volunteer work has been pre. So Wednesdays, I think this is unusual for conferences. We've had a call with every single speaker, every single proposer, and so that's key for us, because we're trying to challenge our participants to bring something that fits with the theme, and we work with them, we combine them, we put them in different places. Mm-hmm. So our volunteers have been integral in that big, as you can imagine, that's a big messy thing. Wednesday's a big messy thing, but they've been integral there. And then all the lovely stuff that has to happen, the promotions, the you know, the setting up of tickets, the information. Sai has done what's the platform, the digital platform?
A Discord
for the community. And so there's loads of information. They've been pulling up lots of information on there. So it's that sort of a wraparound. And then most of those volunteers are participants. You know, there's probably a good 10 people there who are going to come in, and they've never been to a Playposium. It's in their hometown, and they're getting to go to. And so that was one of our rules.
Wonderful. Yes.
If you're going to be at the Playposium, you're not going to volunteer. You're not a volunteer anymore. So it finishes on that.
Got you. And I understood also the city takeover. That means it will be open to anyone strolling by, right?
Multiple events. We're very lucky to have a really incredible library space in the center of town, and we're using that. And there's tickets being free for the community to take and join some of those events. And then it just bleeds. Lisa Forbes' talk is also, we've made that public. because we're talking about a playful society. So we challenged ourselves. We said, okay, how do we
put everyone in a room and let no one hear what we're discussing? Not going to work.
So it's a bit more permeable than I mean, Colorado wasn't permeable at all. We were up on a mountain. So it's that something about the playposium, this place-based reaction to what it is, and that's a really exciting part of the design.
There will be sessions that don't have a room that are just in town.
Oh, yeah, there's people just walking around doing stuff.
Wonderful, wonderful. Wow. I mean, I feel this is really a flavor again. And I would say, maybe we can talk afterwards again or add even more details or the documentation or things that just are artifacts that are being created. But, it's not easy to explain, but still I had the urge and the need to ask you all about, okay, how does it unfold? What is it? And what elements are you specifically, proud of and what was important to you? Now, I guess I can hear, and hopefully our listeners can definitely sense also, not just the motivation, but that you're living this idea of play. And I really want to ask, let's start going back words in my notes. Well, first of all, how do you contrast this playful stance to play as a human need or being human? I'll let you answer that. To someone that then says, you mentioned it shortly, I don't have 15 minutes, or why would we do that? I mean, I'm paid to do lecture here, or in the business world, it's like, wait a minute, we have a strategy meeting. Why would I bother to now do something playful, whatever that means? And how did it? I mean, it's two questions, right? And how did it unfold for you? I mean, personally, I mean, when was that moment that you said, wait a minute, this is not going to work? Okay. Yeah, go back.
So I'll just deal very quickly with the pushback of, I think it's a sort of efficiency, productivity pushback. Now, in another world, I do circular economy, regenerative economics. So that's sort of another world of mine. And I think some people will often say, oh, it's capitalism. And I think Lisa Forbes will be talking about some of this. I don't know if it's the big economic system. It's much more around this efficiency. I always think the efficiency piece in the human push for efficiency is something to be challenged. Something that's really efficient becomes brittle. And we see this in monocultures and agriculture. We see it in systems. Whenever they become ultra efficient, they also become, they've got a fragility to them. And I think that's also the same as the human condition. If you push a human to be ultra efficient and on time and basically be a robot, then you often get this burnout, you get a productivity drop. I mean, that's been evidenced. So what we're very interested in is, actually there's this body of research, not just around play, but cognitive science around how humans flourish and thrive. And as social beings, particularly at a time when our social world feels fragile and more connected and more lonely than ever, that sort of world. We go, well, if you just stop for a moment, take a deep breath and look around, if you're doing the same thing and getting the same result and then doing it again and again and it's still not working, it's the definition of madness. So take that and go, stop for a moment and what's happening here, either with your team or the people? And then hopefully, and this is where we've had some really great experiences, we've had groups come together and let's just experience play and feel the difference. So that 15 minutes up front in anything that we do does such a heavy lift. Mm. And so the first heavy lift it does is it allows the late person to walk in comfortably.
Yes.
And so therefore the group, you're not separate to the group. You're not, it's not that, I've walked into someone talking at a screen. You walk in and you're like, oh, sorry, I'm late. And you're like, not really, because we're just playing some games. So just come over and join us. Mm-hmm. The room forms socially before it forms around the need for work. Work and the economy are ultimately a social construct, right? They are a social thing. So if you take the social out of it, if you take the human aspect out of an economy, you can still have an economy, but it's an economy maybe for robots and not us. Mm-hmm. So what's the point of it? What's the reason for us to be at work or doing this stuff? It is to collaborate, and it's to do that. Mm-hmm. Collaboration relies on trust and belonging. Mm-hmm. Because to belong to something means that you buy into something that is beyond your selfish sort of drive. Mm-hmm. But it also means that the group respects and fosters your own needs. So belonging is a really key part to that collaboration. And then trust is about being able to have that candor, that ability to move something on. The bonkers thing here, Julian, is that play builds all that for you. Like, it just builds it. And it's not a tick box exercise. It's not a defined, oh, we've got to do this, this, and this. If you just create space for play, and you foster it in a bunch of intelligent apes, belonging and trust form in it. And Lisa's early work and her framework shows us in education. We've started to say in our work, you know, if you want collaboration, performance, or innovation, start with play. So I think this is, and I think the community listening to this knows this, right? I think this is not a secret, right? People know this, and then it's about being able to put that into the room. If the resistance we've had in academia, comments about it being frivolous or you know, easy, you're making education easy, and we're not into edutainment. We deliberately head in, as Martin's already mentioned, the discomfort, looking at discomfort and actually understanding that learning happens in a less comfortable space because it's new and newness is uncomfortable. But that frivolousness, the one thing that we found has been the anecdote to that is the amazing work by Stuart Brown and others around the science of play. That biological science, if you put that in front of folk and say, right, here's the science, this is what play does, this is what happens in the brain. We're mammals, and this is across the mammalian family. Play is an aspect of building social complexity. I'm taking your word, sorry, Mark.
I can take that and answer the second question a little bit. How did it become part of my life, for example? I think that was the question, right? How did
From kidneys to play.
Obviously, it was always there, but it was just dormant. Being a researcher, being under a rock, really focused on my research, I always pushed away teaching because that was distracting. It's a very classical research environment. But a couple, and also both my parents were high school teachers, so that's also a place there that I didn't want to teach for a long while. But that, and then I also consider teaching as transactional, and also that sentinel teaching. Here's the information in within the kidney teaching world. It was very typical to have 70 very condensed slides in 60 minutes and just and walk away. It's your responsibility now. But that's not how teaching works, and it's also not where teaching is going at the moment in the last few decades. But I needed to learn that there is something more there, and there's a human-to-human interaction around how learners can learn from you as a teacher. And it changed my perspective by realizing that a little bit by reading the book from Stuart Brown, from what my wife does with life coaching, etc., and having children, and having some therapy, looking at my own self, that I wanted to bring more of my whole self. And then I used my academic training to look at the biological science of play, but in an experimental applied way. So I looked at the evidence, and then I used my classrooms as the new laboratory, if you like. Sorry, students. That's a real reason. That really started to snowball, and you meet people, you meet the community, and Adam and I start to work together. A huge influence that hasn't been mentioned here is Stanford D School Design School, so the design thinking approach, which really complemented what I was doing at the time, and sort of full circle to the tick box that now how I use play in my education. Sometimes I have something up my sleeve like a game, but if the play then already happens in the room, because then it's the intention again, right? I wanted to have some kind of feeling that they are trust each other enough and start talking about the subject, but sometimes now in the classroom that is already there, and then I don't do my game because it's exactly what's already happening. So it's really being intentional what you're actually trying to create, rather than to have a tick box. It has to be playful, and I had to learn that, because I had it had quite often in my head it has to be playful. But if it was already happening, unfolding, so yeah, that's a little bit behind the curtain about how that arose for me from.
And then you mentioned, you know, something for me also very important when you said, I wanted to have that feeling that it's unfolding, right? So I do believe that when we invite to play, there's so many things happening simultaneously. You call it like messy, it's unfolding, right? And that's so much data. I totally believe that some facilitators, I will ask you about your ultimate facilitation tip in a second, but sometimes you can get overwhelmed with what is happening, or I don't know how you mentioned, right? It's like, okay, wait a minute, there's a little bit of rebellion here, and there's something happening there, and I didn't plan for that, and oh my God, and I think in 20 minutes food is coming, right? So there is a lot to, I would say, juggle with, or at least to, you know, cut through the fog and noise, and then to then deliberately make a decision, you know, based on.
I'll pick up on that point, Julie. I think one of the, well, this is a D-School practice, mm-hmm. that they, every course they run has two instructors, dual facilitation. And it was sort of by accident that Martin and I started doing what we were doing, and we connected. But we were, you know, we model the idea that there's two at the front of the room. And we've implemented that across innovation entrepreneurship in the business school. We have two at the front of the room, slightly larger rooms, mm-hmm. but more social and more activated. I think this is something that is worth noting is if you're going to model social behavior, connection and play, having a play buddy at the front of the room with you is a really great way, particularly when you're teaching youngsters, to show them how, oh, this is, we're going to do a bit of improv and it doesn't go quite well, but it's messy, and that gives them their permission to be in the room. So I think that's something that we really encourage, is people to find people to collaborate with. And again, you know, two in the room, oh, more time, that means more money. But it just, you know, it builds that social thread so quickly, it's so easy.
Yes. And then when I come back to what you said, you know, in terms of bringing your whole self, right, into that room, that's also, especially in when we teach, important to just remind our fellow learners and players that it's more than a business model canvas, or it's more than a strategy meeting, or it's more than
no business model canvas has ever resulted in a great business, Julian. That's the reality.
Yeah, don't get me started on that.
But great businesses have a great business model. Oh, hang on.
You'd have afterwards only, right? But Adam, also what you said, you know, in terms of our listeners know, I think it's still very, very important to A, put it in so many different words, why it's important, and your journey to play, and then why this is, you know, more than a method that you're using, right? And secondly, also reminding everyone, I think Matthias mentioned that in the Counterplay episode, you know, we're not alone, right? It's not that, oh, you found, you know, Stuart's book and now you are motivated. No, there are many, many, and there are so many different ways, or the landscape of play is so broad and and so diverse that there's something for everyone. And at the end of the day, there's research and we are all at one point. You mentioned the children, the learning. I do love to think about adult learning, obviously, also in terms of experimenting. And then you mentioned a few sources and this iterative work and being safe or brave in a room without real world consequences. And you mentioned pro-social and so on. There's so much we can just unlock or tap into when we offer some playful moments. Wow. Here's my, I'm just looking at the time. I feel sad now that our time is almost over. So I don't know. I will link everything that you mentioned, okay? From Lisa Forbes' site and book and Sid Brown and D-School and, of course, Wife Hosium. So that will be covered in the show notes. Okay, I'll just start here and then we'll see what happens. What is your ultimate facilitation tip to someone who says, that sounded like something that I want to, a journey that I want to embark on. And what is your ultimate facilitation tip for someone who's inviting others to play?
Well, it's sort of tempting to say this activity or this card deck or this, that's on the one side, and otherwise you go to be yourself, be your whole self, or somewhere in the middle, and especially as the being trained as a researcher, it is the experimentation, the experimental stance. So that includes failing, right? Because that is 90% of research is actually the whole research theory is about disproving things rather than proving things. I won't go there, but experimental mindset, and then start small. Just as small as where it is just a little bit uncomfortable.
I can give an example of an actual thing that colleagues have done after they've been through an Oglet studio. Just playing music at the beginning of your lecture or at your room. So you've got some music on. We've had multiple colleagues say, I just played some music and the room was different. And I was like, oh, isn't that interesting? So it can be something very small. And it can just lead to that shift in the room and that warmth that we're talking about. And I think that can be a really good part.
And that does bring me to one of my favorite metaphors of how to apply play. And that is DJing the room, DJing your experience, being the DJ. So create the conditions where you get the response that you're looking for.
You're not teaching the dance moves, you're creating the floor and the atmosphere for the dance moves to unfold, and that's a different approach to the intention of the room. I'll jump in and say that I think for a lot of folk, it's finding a way to let go of the room and then bring the room back, because what we've observed is that particularly in higher education, there's a fear that once you let go of the room and you've got 200 18-year-olds talking, and they love to talk, by the way, this is a lovely thing, that how do you pull them back and how do you pull that room back? And you've got to find a way that's comfortable for you and for them, and there's multiple ways to do it. That is, we probably advocate that a whistle or something loud is not the thing, because it's a real interruption to the cognitive flow. But I was with this facilitator who used a really beautiful gong sound, like they just tapped this beautiful and it just radiated across the room, and then the room just came back quiet, like it was just a really gorgeous thing. But that for me is the, once you've experimented with the room, sort of releasing the room and bringing the room back, that gives you then a huge amount of confidence and ability to let that social interaction happen. And so I think that's something that we work hard on in the Play Studio is like, how do you hold a room? Now, we use something that they use at D-School, which is hands up, which you use for five-year-olds. We love it. We get lots of pushback. Oh, why am I? Well, do you know what? It's quiet and it's really easy. and it's a really beautiful thing. And if you hold it, and this is something I'll also say is really interesting. Some colleagues put their hands up and they start talking and the room's not quiet. And you're like, this is another thing about being in the moment and going, I've got to have some sort of ability to hold this room. Mm-hmm. And if I don't have the room, you can't move forward. And so if we're really talking about that facilitation world, Julian, really talking about activating play in the room, play can be very quiet and contemplative, like a game of chess. But that also relies a room to be really settled and contemplative. So you still need to be able to control the atmosphere of the room and therefore have some sort of influence over your participants. Or it can be one of our favorite games is called Happy Salmon. Mm-hmm. It can be mad and wild and noisy and crazy. And in both of those conditions, you need to be comfortable with letting the room go and mm-hmm. pulling the room back and changing that energy. So for me, facilitation has always radiated around how you create your presence in the room and how you do that. I think, I think a lot of the audience will know that. I just think that that's the thing to pass on is finding your way of doing that.
Wonderful. Well, thank you. Thank you.
Find your way. Boom.
The punchline of this episode. Find your way of play. You just shortly mentioned InnoPlay Studio. We did not talk about this at the beginning. So you two met. You're also working up, I understand, part-time, Maude and you at the same university, right? So I'll link everything about you. But what about InnoPlay Studio? Is that something... So
Martin and I put our heads together in 2022, mm-hmm. at the end of 2022, and we created, I have some teaching spaces around innovation entrepreneurship, and I'd been to D school and I was doing design thinking, and Martin came into my world and went, oh, there's a thing called play. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. Oh, yeah, well, let's do that. And we created something very quickly. I mean, we met it was just after sort of for us lockdown had come out, and we met mm-hmm. physically for a coffee. About 90 minutes later from that coffee, we had our first event already organized and a diary. Mm-hmm. And what that was called Playful Lab. And what mm-hmm. we did is every Thursday for term time, we just ran a Playful Lab. And it was our little experiment, a space for experiment, mm-hmm. place for colleagues to come in and experiment. And it sort of concertinaed in and out. It was a bit messy. But then off the back of that, Martin did most of the work on this, the InnoPlay idea came out. Like, what's this entity? It's not a research center in the traditional sense. It's something else. And we do have this sort of core acorn, which is innovation and play. And you put those two together and you get InnoPlay. InnoPlay, Martin was already in this world. He was getting pulled by colleagues left, right, and center. Come and run something playful. Come and we sat back and went, this is going to kill us. We're going to be dead by the end of the year because we're just going to be turning up for like 10 minutes of play and we're just going to be pulled apart. So we said, okay, we're going to create a course for other facilitators, and that's InnoPlay Studio. That's the now a 5-day course which we run in our makerspace within the business school. We take facilitators, educators through a process of exploring play from a personal, from a techniques point of view, and probably from a wider point of view. And at the end of it, that's our hope, is that somebody has this playful courage and the ability to go back and really inject play into their lives.
Wonderful. Wow. Is there anything we have not talked about? what a big question.
Well, we were spoken about your session at Playposium, but we're not going to do that.
Oh, wonderful. Yes. Come and see that about the debriefing cube. I'll link everything that you mentioned. And of course, also InnoPlay Studio and the Happy Salmon game. And, you know, wow. Are there any final famous last words? Again, just for this episode.
Well, what we say to ourselves a lot, because we're talking about confidence and creative confidence is something we talk a lot about, and experimentation and what I just said, the starting small, the small experiments, something that really helps when you have a play body and think about the experiments, how they went, what went well, what went wrong, is in the end, is trust the process.
And Adam is
nodding his head. Trust the process.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, you know, both of you, to take the time out of your busy pre-and-prep-playposium time to talk to our listeners and me. Thank you so much.
Julian, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Julian. And it was our pleasure. Yeah, it was also just grateful for reaching out and want to hear some more about us. That's just so appreciated. Thank you.
Absolutely. It's so important. I will also link all the other episodes about, you know, playful communities out there. I do believe we all have way more in common, you know, different approaches, maybe different motivations, different history. But at the end of the day, you know, we all want to bring more play into our lives or bring it back to our lives or, okay, we'll figure that out later. And to all our listeners, well, either, you know, book your ticket and your flight and come and, you know, play with us and experience the Playposium in Exeter, or have a look around on social media and the websites. Again, there have been other Playposiums out there, so there's some, you know, buzz and some documentation and some blog posts, etc. Available. And if not, you know, look out. End of June, it's going to happen, and we're going to post. I'm not sure. Let's see. Sometimes I have the feeling, if there's not too much going on social media during the conference, that's actually a good sign, right? Because people are really focused and drawn in, and they're like, yeah, but we'll see. Yeah. And afterwards, you could definitely read that up. Adam, over to you.
Well, what do I have to say?
No, you were nodding. I thought, yeah, you're
taking a breath.
Sorry, I was immersed in what you were saying. I was like, yeah, social media. I just realized that actually Colorado, we didn't have a signal very easily. And so social media wasn't even a thing. We didn't even have our phones out. So I was just thinking, oh, what's going to be the difference this time? Maybe people won't have their phones out. It's sort of
never know, right? But that's a social aspect, right? And then it's called social media. I think that's for a reason. But
well, actually,
it's not so social, right? Because
Julian, there's a lovely journalist in the New York Times, and he calls it algorithmic media. Mm. And I happen to think that algorithmic media is a more appropriate term right now for what it is.
Yes, yes. And it messes with our attention and focus and energy. And if you want to have that all focused on the Playposium, come and see us there. If not, please do feel free to reach out to, you know, any one of us to talk about play, to ask questions, to give us feedback about, you know, the questions or the session and the podcast. And we're looking forward to that. Till next time, bye-bye.
You can reach us at hello@keylearning.net. We're looking forward to your suggestions, comments, and feedback.